Hello, everyone. It's Employment Law 101. There's a distinct lack of
hands
to my left on my screen. I just want to point that out to everyone. I hope you are all well. I can see you're all filtering in. As you do that, I'm going to just crack on straight away with a reminder of who we are and what we're doing today. So I'm Sarah. This is Peter, and we are both partners at MPM Legal, which is, for those of you that don't know, a boutique employment law and business immigration firm. We're based in Henley-on-Thames, which is a lovely part of the world to be based in, but we actually work with clients all over the country and through our network of boutique and other firms internationally, we potentially work with clients all over the world, particularly clients who are wanting to set up in the UK. I should also mention, because it's my particular baby, that we now have a sister company, MPM Included, which is an inclusion and diversity consultancy. So hopefully we can offer a really wide, all-encompassing approach to any of your people needs. So Employment Law 101, just have to do the jazz hands whenever I say it, is something that we set up because we recognise that people don't have a lot of time, but they want to know what's going on in the employment law world. So we decided to run through our view of an employee life cycle with short 25 to 30 minute webinars on different aspects of the life cycle. And today, Peter and I have got the not entirely happy topic of redundancies to talk about. So if you are sitting comfortably, then we'll begin. Peter.
Yeah. Good morning. Hi, everybody. No jazz hands for me today. Next time. So we're talking about redundancy. What constitutes a redundancy situation? Well, rather helpfully, the Employment Rights Act tells us. So there is a statutory definition of what redundancy is. It breaks down into three different things, basically. You've got what we can call business closures. So an entire business just ceases to exist. Then we've got workplace closures as well. So for those of you who operate branches or an office network, for example, closing down one or more of those may also constitute a redundancy situation. And then the third one, I'm going to use the statutory wording, which for those of you that work with us, you know we're not particular fans of legalese, but it's important, I think, in this context. And this third category is a diminished requirement of the business for employees to do work of a particular kind. You can kind of paraphrase it as you need fewer employees to do work or to do something that you're offering. But, you know, no doubt somebody could pick holes in that paraphrasing. So always good to refer back to what the statutory definition is. In the real world, what all of that means really is we're talking about things like changes due to recessions or economic pressures. We're talking about perhaps changes in service provision, the offering that your business provides. We're talking about internal reorganizations as well. They can trigger a redundancy situation. Tech development. So perhaps in the future, we're all going to be replaced by robots and there'll be a robot sat here delivering this webinar and I'll be redundant. But the modernization of the workplace and the use of technology is certainly seeing quite a big shift. And hopefully it will not necessarily lead to redundancy job losses, but mere redeployment into different roles. But basically, development of tech can have an impact. And relocation, of course, as well. It's quite a common scenario where you've got businesses moving around the country and relocating, or indeed relocating part of a service offering from one location to another. That can also trigger a redundancy situation too, though beware of mobility clauses, as I'll come on and mention a little bit later. There is a separate concept of business reorganization. So you can actually have business reorganizations that stop short of triggering a redundancy situation. Obviously, it's very context and fact specific if you're into the realms of that. But sometimes you can rejig roles. I suppose the easiest example I've got is just thinking about changing management structures and levels, for example, maybe going from quite a hierarchical structure to a flatter structure. Everybody may still be doing the same jobs and a redundancy situation may not be triggered and it would just be classed as a business reorganization. The other point I wanted to mention here is about SOSR dismissal. So for those of you familiar with that, some other substantial reason. So sometimes there may be fundamental changes that you're making. They don't quite trigger a redundancy situation, but it would justify some other substantial reason for dismissal. And that is a fair reason in law to be able to dismiss somebody. And my example there is perhaps you need to drastically reduce some employees' hours of work. But you still need the same number of employees. So you're not satisfying that diminished requirements of the business for employees test that I mentioned, but you do need to change fundamentally how they're working. Now, if you are sitting there thinking, well, why is this all important? Why do we need to get redundancies right? When it comes to unfair dismissal liability, and that's the main liability that we're talking about here, we've got to think about not only the substantive fairness of why somebody has been dismissed, bearing in mind that redundancy is a potentially fair reason to be able to dismiss somebody, but also there's this concept of procedural fairness as well. So you can have a potentially fair reason to dismiss somebody, but we all know if you get that process wrong, you could lose on the process and fall down there. And that's not a particularly comfortable place to be in terms of negotiating strategy if you're trying to avoid actually getting in front of an employment tribunal judge on one of these cases. Sarah, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very easy to think you've got this right and get it wrong in a way that doesn't seem particularly fundamental, but actually, as you said, it just puts you on the back foot when it comes to any kind of legal liability down the line. And the thing is, we don't spend a lot of time, believe it or not, advising our clients about tribunals per se. A lot of our advice is about how to not get into a tribunal, and that might be by doing it right in the first place, ideally, but it might also be by negotiating. And if you've already shot yourself in the foot from a negotiating perspective, that's not really a very good place to start. One of the things that I always ask clients when they come to me with a redundancy situation, and I think it's because I was so scarred by a case that not my case thankfully, but a case that had a slightly wonky decision a few years ago that was later corrected, is how many people are you making redundant? And that's really important because you might not actually just be dealing with individual redundancy, which is the Employment Rights Act definition that Peter was talking about, but you might also have a collective situation. And collective redundancy, it's really important to understand how many people you are proposing to dismiss as redundant, and I'm choosing my words really carefully there because that's another statutory definition, at a particular establishment. Now, I'm not going to go into the whys and wherefores of the Woolworths case, which scarred me particularly when I was an in-house lawyer, because at one point I was responsible for the spreadsheet that checked how many people were being made redundant in the whole organisation at any given time, which was quite a stressful situation. If you want to read up on that case, let me know and I can give you the link to it, but I wouldn't recommend. We've gone back to orthodoxy now, and the orthodoxy is that if you are proposing to dismiss 20 or more people as redundant within a rolling 90-day period, that you are in a collective redundancy situation. Now, there's a real watch out there that I just want to draw your attention to straight away, which is this notion of proposing to dismiss as redundant. It's wider than just the redundancy definition that Peter talked about. It could encompass any reason for dismissal that isn't directly related to the individual. And what I mean about that is, let's say you wanted to change terms and conditions for 50 people in your business. And ultimately, if you couldn't get them to agree, which obviously is the starting point when you're looking to change contractual T's and C's, you decided that you would dismiss them and then re-engage them.
That's the classic, isn't it? That's the classic scenario we come across.
Yeah, 100%. And it's really, really important to understand that if you're proposing to do that, and I would just have it in the back of your mind that if you're going to change terms and conditions, you need to have an eye to, have I got a collective redundancy situation? And it's a really good opportunity to pick up the phone to one of us just to check in, because people often get that wrong. And that situation, because you're proposing to dismiss those people potentially as, like, you know, the outlying position, that is a collective redundancy situation, even though you're not actually losing any headcount in the long run, or that's not your intention.
So that's a trap there, isn't it? That you get into that mindset of, well, it's okay, we're going to rehire everybody under this contract that's available for us.
And it's really, really important, because if you mess up collective redundancy or you fail to do it at all, there's a punitive measure, a punitive award from the tribunal. So most tribunal awards are intended to compensate people, but this one is actually intended to punish the employer for not doing what they're supposed to do. And it's 90 days uncapped pay per employee. So it's not subject to any statutory cap. So if you've got some high earners, if you've got a large group of employees and you've got some high earners in there, that could be quite a serious cost for your business if you get that wrong. So that's my, like, please watch out for that. If you've got a collective situation, whether it's a traditional redundancy situation or it's T's and C's, there's a minimum period that you have to consult for before the first of the dismissals takes effect. So generally we say to people, you really should be doing that consultation before you give people notice, because that's just a cleaner way to do it. But actually in law, you can include right up until those people actually leave the business, which I always find a bit strange, Peter, when you're kind of dealing with something that's supposed to be meaningful consultation. But I think that's the way that the law lies on that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's as long as the prerequisite period of time has passed from when you've placed the first people at risk of redundancy to when their dismissal actually takes effect, then you're in the clear. I think, you know, for those of you who've been doing this job for a while now and been involved in these larger scale exercises, you'll remember that quite a few years now, I think, the law changed. And instead of having a much longer consultation period, it was chopped, or more accurately, period between placing people at risk of redundancy and the dismissal taking effect, to be pedantic about it. That period was chopped right down. And because certainly in terms of the practical scenarios that we were advising on, you might get let's say 3 or 4 weeks in and just run out of things to talk about, you know, especially in like a business closure scenario. It might be quite obvious what's happening, and you might talk about an enhanced redundancy package, you might talk about the impact on the business, you might talk about what steps you've tried to do to mitigate the closure of the business. But if that is what's happening and the decision is then subsequently confirmed, there's going to be, you know, relatively little to talk about as time goes on. And I think, you know, the trade unions were on board with the concept that it did seem a bit of a situation where certainly a lot of employees would be saying, look, we know what's happening, we just want to get on with our lives as well.
Yeah. It's a really stressful position to be in if you're kind of part of a large scale, well, any kind of redundancy, but a part of a large scale redundancy as an individual. So the periods that you're looking for, and we just had a question on this, which I was coming to, I promise. If it's 20 or more employees in that rolling 90-day period, it's 30 days consultation. If it's 100 or more, then it's 45 days consultation. And Peter's quite right, that used to be 90 days, and the Conservative government chopped it right down when they came into power. I think that's when that happened. So just bear that in mind, that you need to think widely about your definition of redundancy, and you need to, if you're in a collective situation, you need to have that long period of consultation. The way Peter just described what should happen during the consultation was perfect as well, because actually it's really important that you're not just paying lip service and kind of going, oh, this is what's happening, so now you tell us what you think. It's got to be actively intended to try and avoid redundancies, try and mitigate their effects, etc., etc. So it's really important that it's meaningful consultation. Now, I don't want to take the whole session up on collective consultation, but there's just two more points that I wanted to make. One is, part of that consultation process, it starts once you've got reps in place that you can consult with, and you have to consult with reps of the affected employees. So another watch out there might not just be the employees if you're doing a headcount reduction that are subject to that. It might be other employees whose jobs are going to change, for example, as a result of that sort of wider reorganisation. So make sure you get your reps right for the people who are affected. If you've got a TU in place, then you have to consult with the union. But if you haven't, you need to get some reps in place. And that's an election process, which, again, is something I won't go into detail here because it's something we can help you with. It's quite a formulaic process. But something that we found really effective, and actually I've done quite a lot of this, and Peter, I think you've done quite a bit of it too, is quite often we'll go in and train the reps of companies that we act for. So it's a bit of a strange situation. They certainly always look at me as if I'm a spy. I wish I was that. And I always have to say, look, I just want to be clear. I can't give you legal advice, but I'm here to talk to you about your role. And generally the feedback, without exception, the feedback on that has always been, it's been really, really helpful to have an hour with those reps to just talk them through what they need to do. Because do you know what? If you're not an HR professional or an employment lawyer, why would you know? Why would you know what you have to do as an employee?
Yeah, completely. And the training I've done is just making sure that the reps are best equipped to understand conceptually what's happening, the reasons why it's happening. I'm not talking about the business reasons, but I'm talking about the legal framework as to why we have to go through this actual process, and what they can do to make best use of their position as reps, because, you know, real responsibility lies in that role. If they're doing it properly, you know, they are the conduit for information flowing between the company and the individual employees who are affected. And, you know, I've seen exercises where there's been a failure there and things don't go so smoothly. So it's always in the business interest for things to run as smoothly as possible, as little friction as possible. I think upskilling the reps really, really helps with that, in my experience too.
I think it helps them feel supported, which is really important, because you've got the double whammy of being subject to redundancy and being responsible for consulting on behalf of all of your colleagues and friends. And that's a lot. One final thing on collective, and then we must scoot on because there's a lot to cover. HR1 form. Do not forget to complete your HR1 form if you are doing a collective redundancy, because if you do, it is a criminal offence. Okay. It's a really silly form. I have never yet done a collective redundancy for any clients or as an in-house lawyer where what we're doing actually in any way fits into the form. So what I tend to do is fill out the form and then do a covering letter explaining what we've done and why we're doing it. And that tends to satisfy, I don't know how you pronounce it anymore, BIS.
Anyway,
the government department. That tends to satisfy them. And you sort of get your retaliation in first, so you don't get hundreds of questions because you've explained everything really clearly. But for goodness sake, if I can leave you with any points from this, my first watch out is make sure you're clear on whether it's redundancy or not, even if it doesn't look like one. And the other one is, for goodness sake, don't forget your HR1 form. Peter.
Yeah, I think just a couple of tips from me on that part of it, actually. Just tying in with what you said about contractual changes and, you know, fire and rehire tactics, and forgetting that that can trigger redundancy because of the wider definition of redundancy that's in that other bit of legislation. I've certainly encountered situations where businesses are really, understandably, really reluctant to want to do an HR1 form because they're thinking, well, where's this information going? We're completing an official form talking about redundancy. It's not redundancy because we've got jobs for everyone. And you've just kind of got to get over that mental block of, look, we know we're going to be looking after everybody. Hopefully everybody's going to sign, take on the new contracts as well. But really to avoid that criminal liability that Sarah was talking about, or, you know, any hint that you've done something unlawful, it's better just to get on and do it. The other tip I had as well was, when we're dealing with employee reps, I've certainly seen organizations where they have like a standing committee of employees. And, you know, sometimes it's to talk about, well, you know, back in the day, I remember working somewhere where they had one, and the main topic of conversation in the meetings was about the air conditioning in one of the offices. But, you know, one of those employee bodies about, you know, are we getting enough holiday? Is the air conditioning at the right temperature? So on and so forth. You've got to make sure, if you're intending to consult with those standing reps, that actually they were always in place for the purposes of 2B consultation. Chances are they probably haven't been put in place for that, but that's just a watch out. Sorry, Sarah, because I know, in terms of talking about collective, we could do like a full morning on it, really, couldn't we? Because there's so much ground.
But we're not going to. We're going to move on.
Individual. So individual redundancies. Now, there's a nice segue, because quite a common question is, well, if we're doing collective redundancy, we can just completely forget about individual redundancy, can't we? No. It's like a horrified look on Sarah's face. You can't. There comes a point where you... How can I best describe this? You kind of tone down the collective. So basically you get to a point where you've talked about everything that you think you can talk about collectively and with the reps. And that can include the process that you follow for individual consultation. But then there still does have to be an individual consultation element to these exercises. So yes, unfortunately, that may mean arranging individual one-to-one consultation meetings with 100, 200, however many hundreds of people are impacted. But you will need to factor that into your timescale process. Obviously, if we're talking about small scale redundancies from the off, so you're in a business where you're looking at maybe one role as being redundant, or you know, up to 20 roles, or 19 roles as being redundant, you run it as an individual consultation process. Now, when we're talking about individual redundancy, there are no specific timescales. It all feeds into the fairness and the procedural fairness of the process that you're trying to run, but the law doesn't mandate any minimum consultation period. Now, I think as a rule of thumb, you should really look at a minimum of a couple of weeks, a couple of working weeks at least.
I just want to lean into the camera and look at everyone and say, please do not ask me if you can do it in a week.
You're just running a real risk. And I mean, unless there's a really, really good reason, you've just got to plan ahead a little bit more, because it's just going to look completely rushed and predetermined. And you're just giving someone the ammunition to come back at you and say, you know, I was placed at risk on a Monday and I was given notice on a Friday. Clearly, it's not a fair process. So don't be tempted to do that.
I'm going to be a bit humanitarian about this just for a second, but this is also people's lives that we're talking about. I think there's a real sweet spot with employment law of kind of a mixture of common sense and empathy. And if that was me and I was losing my job, you know, I'd spend the first week being quite shocked and then start to process. So I think that's the other reason. I'm sorry to, you know, bust the myth that employment lawyers aren't human, but we are, in fact. And I think you've got to be human there as well.
But yeah, I mean, it's a really valid point, because why upset people unnecessarily? Because in my experience, that just leaves them feeling like they want to come back at you. And what that means is issue a tribunal claim against you. So, you know, that's really valid. But two main things I wanted to talk about in terms of individual redundancy, bearing in mind no minimum timescales to follow, is pooling and criteria. So pooling, for those of you that don't know, is do you need to look at who is actually being placed at risk of redundancy? So an example might be if you've got three people doing very similar overlapping roles, you decide that you need only one person within your business doing that job. Maybe you've had a downturn in work. You would look to pool all three together and then apply some selection criteria to that pool to decide which two are going to unfortunately be made redundant and which person isn't. Now, when it comes to pooling, you've got an awful lot of discretion. You've got a lot of wriggle room in terms of how you decide what the pool should be. And generally, an employment tribunal won't, what we call, pierce the corporate veil. They won't pull back the curtain and peek behind it and have a look in too much detail about the intricacies of that decision. What you do need to be able to evidence is that you've thought about pooling. Now, sometimes it's going to be really obvious. You've got someone who's doing a standalone job. It's a pool of one. So you don't need to look at bringing in, you know, all these colleagues into that pool, because it's obvious it is just one. But of course, it's not always as straightforward as that. So be able to evidence that you've thought about pooling. So first question, is there a pooling issue here? Do we need to pool? And then just record the process that you've gone through, the thought process you've gone through, and the decision that you've made, and just maybe a couple of bullet points on the reasons why you've made that decision. Because then if you're challenged about it in 6 months, 12 months time, you can say, actually, yeah, I did think about whether pooling was appropriate. Here's what I considered. This is the decision I reached, and here's the reasons why. Now, as I said before, the ET is not going to kind of go into too much detail to try and undermine the decision that you've made. You've got a lot of latitude to make that decision as well, but you need to be able to pass the red face test, basically, and show that it was it's a credible position for you to have held. So if we talk about criteria quickly, if you're looking at a comparison exercise, so in my example, again, you're scoring three people to try and work out who's best for the role, you've got to do your best to make sure that those criteria are objective and measurable. Now, the way I like to think of it is you've got objective criteria, and those criteria are capable of independent verification, i.e. an employment judge can look at it and say, yes, we can see where you've got these scores from. To give you a quick flavour of what's not acceptable, there have been cases on this. Attitude, scoring someone on their attitude, and that crops up questions to me quite a lot, is not acceptable. You can't really measure somebody's attitude. Well, some of you may argue that you can, but not in a kind of...
If you had it in a performance review, for example, so if you had ongoing performance reviews that also address behaviours and values, for example, as a lot of clients do now, I think that would be okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's kind of diluted.
But not just you've got a bad attitude with nothing to, it's all about evidence in the end.
Exactly. Or even, no, this person's got the right attitude that we need going forward.
Yeah.
What does that mean? You know, related to that, best for the business. We've scored based on who's best for the business here. Now, you know, okay.
That's a discrimination claim.
Behind the scenes, we know that in reality, sometimes, let's say just sometimes, redundancy situations are engineered so companies get the right outcome that they want. Shock horror. But, you know, if you're in a position where it's a bit grey and you're looking to justify the decision that you've made, you're going to need to come up with that objective evidence. And so someone's attitude, we think this person's best for the business, that sort of stuff isn't going to cut it. It's got to be something that's more more objective, basically. What about when it comes to the consultation process, Sarah? I know you've got some ideas about...
Well, the thing that I really wanted to zone in on there, which really, really sort of comes into your point about how you select people, is discrimination. I already mentioned it with my horrified face on, but you've got to be really, really careful. And there's a well-known case from a law firm, actually, a law firm that I once worked for briefly, called Eversheds. It wasn't me, by the way, who brought the case. About trying to do the right thing in a redundancy situation to avoid discrimination and falling headfirst into a different type of discrimination. So just to go into that really quickly, because I think this is a really important case, because it really highlights how easy it is to get this wrong if you don't think through all of the possibilities. Very, very short summary of the facts. Eversheds were going through a redundancy exercise. They had various people. One of their selection criteria, which was objective, was something called lockout. And what lockout means for Eversheds is the time period between the work being done by the lawyer and the fees being received by the firm. And they had a man and a woman who were both at risk of redundancy. The woman was on maternity leave. Now, there's all sorts of separate issues about women on maternity leave and Regulation 10 and their right to be placed into a role that we're not going to go into today. We'll probably cover that off when we talk about family-friendly rights. But just be aware, there is an added sort of extra that you need to think about if someone who's at risk of redundancy is on maternity leave, because they're protected. So that's just another watch out that we can talk to you about offline. Anyway. The guy's lockstep score was 0.5, and the woman didn't have a lockstep. Well, her lockstep score was zero because she'd been on maternity leave, so she hadn't been billing or receiving fees. And what Eversheds did, trying to be fair to her in their defence, was to give her a score of 2, which was the highest score. And the guy said, well, hang on a minute, if you just pluck that out of the air, and I think that that's discriminatory against me as a man. And actually, what I think you should have done is to take her lockstep score from the last period that she was actively working before maternity leave. And if you did that, it would have been the same as mine, 0.5. But actually, overall, I would have scored higher than her. And the courts agreed with that, because what they said is, it's really, really good to have an eye to discrimination in these situations. But if you're in a situation, a tricky situation like that, where your objective criteria don't actually add up or don't quite work because someone's been out of the business for a long time, you know, could be maternity leave, could be long-term sick, whatever it happens to be, yes, you should absolutely think about adjustments you can make, but they've got to be proportionate. And what you did wasn't proportionate, because you just went, oh, okay, we'll give her the highest score then. And that resulted in an injustice to someone else, in this case a man. So I just think that's a really interesting case about how you've just got to think about these tricky situations and think about the fairest way of dealing with them. And if you do deal with them, it's another evidence point, really. You know, if you decide to do something for a certain reason, then record it so that your thinking is there and independently verifiable down the line, just in case. The other point, because I'm really conscious of time, the other point that I just wanted to make before I hand over to Peter for some closing thoughts about settlement agreements is the question I always get, without exception, is about the right to time off to look for other work when you're at risk of redundancy. If you've been given notice of redundancy and you've got more than 2 years service and you want to go and look for employment or even make arrangements for training to improve your employment prospects, then you have a right to reasonable time, paid time off. That right is protected by the Employment Tribunal for up to 40% of the working week is protected and can be claimed in the Employment Tribunal if it's not given. Now, clients always look at me in abject horror, and then they look even more horrified when I tell them that actually it could be reasonable to give them even more time than that. But in reality, the claim in the Employment Tribunal is limited to 40% of the working week. That's 2 days a week for someone who works full time that they could be have the right to paid time off during their notice period while they're at notice of redundancy. So just be really, really aware of that, because I've had a lot of clients who have been really surprised and have actually got into some quite nasty tussles with employees because they haven't been prepared to give them the time. And then they've come to us after the fact, and I've had to say, look, I'm sorry, but actually there is this quite extensive right to look for further work. Mm-hmm. So, Peter, that's my whistle stop trip through. I know you just wanted to touch on
fast forward into sort of end of the process, but we've had a question which I'll just address quickly if I may. The question is, what about telling an employee? I think this is relevant to selection. What about telling an employee at this time, I don't believe you're bringing your whole self to the business and the career options for you may not meet your expectations going forward, is not mentioning specifically your fit. Could this be a discriminatory issue? Well, I think it's very context specific, actually. If I illustrate it by an example, if you're having that discussion with somebody who's perhaps 60 years old and the other people in the pool are significantly younger, what you're doing is just opening the door for that person to say, well, the only reason that you're saying this to me is because of my age and you just want to bump me out. Now, you can replace age for any other protected characteristic under the Equality Act as well. And that's the risk there. But the reason I say it's context specific is because, you know, you might have three people who are all very well matched. They may all be white males in their 30s, for example, and you're having this discussion and you might reasonably think then, well, actually, the risk profile of one person off the back of that discussion coming forward and saying you're only doing this because of this protected characteristic is much lower risk because, you know, all three of them share similar protected characteristics and so there isn't anything in it. So I think context is everything, really. But the danger, and certainly, you know, clients of mine have these types of discussions all the time, but the danger of it is if you do get it wrong, you're just opening the door for somebody to allege that actually there's a discriminatory or just a simple unfair reason as to why you're having that discussion and redundancy is being used as a veil.
I think the other watch out on that, just with my inclusion hat on, is telling someone that they're not bringing them their whole selves to the business. That might not be their fault. It might actually be your fault, not you personally, whoever asked the question, but it might be the business's fault. It might be an environment that they feel they can't bring them their whole selves to work. So I think that's quite it feels to me a little bit like a minefield, that one.
Yeah, but we're always up for a bit of risk if you're up for a bit of risk. So as long as you, you know, go into these things with your eyes open, understanding what can happen, you know, we can help with that process. Yes, as Sarah mentioned, I was just going to wrap up by talking about settlement agreements. So fast forwarding to the end of the process, it's very, very common both in individual redundancy situations and, of course, still within collective redundancy consultations, things end up with settlement agreements being signed and rights being waived, the ability to bring certain claims being waived, and money changing hands in exchange, normally an enhanced redundancy payment, of course. Just some strategic things to think about there are, are you going to offer an enhanced redundancy payment? Obviously, if you're not, you're not going to be getting any waiver of claims back in return. So I think that points you to being absolutely squeaky clean in terms of the process that you're following to make people redundant. Secondly, I think if you're ever making a payment that's over and above the statutory payment, it is always worth getting some value back for doing that. So I think the value that you want back is a waiver of claims. The value the individuals are getting are obviously the difference between their statutory entitlements and the extra that you're prepared to pay. But then other things to think about are, well, if we're going to enhance it, how are we going to enhance it? Are we going to remove the statutory cap on a week's pay? Are we going to pay a multiplier? So instead of a week for a full year of employment, we might pay a month, for example, if you're feeling especially generous. What are you going to do about timing of departures, garden leave, notice pay? Will you pay notice pay on top? And are you going to be serving notice? So all of those things to factor into your planning process when you're looking at these exercises as well. What can really help is organising it so a third-party law firm come on site or now virtually advise all of the employees who are signing settlement agreements, because you can manage a much cleaner process. Instead of dealing with individuals who are going and getting legal advice on settlement agreements from 50 different employment lawyers who are all making 50 different points and asking for varying fee contributions, you can manage and try and funnel it all through one firm as well and make the process very, very slick. What that does is it frees you up to concentrate on getting the actual substantive decisions right. And that's what's really key. Where we see these exercises going really, really well, both in terms of individual and collective redundancies, is the planning. It's planning, 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 basically. If you're trying to do things on the back of a fag packet at the last minute, that's where you've got a much bigger risk profile and scope for things to go wrong. If you're leading into it with enough time to know exactly what the milestones are that you want to hit in the process, where the risk areas lie, we can work together and basically make it all as smooth as possible. We've got another question actually, just before we wrap up, maybe Sarah, if there's Eversheds example.
Yeah, just go back to the Eversheds case. Firstly, question from Anna, thank you. Judging the woman's performance based on the period in the lead up to her pregnancy, could this not be seen as unfair? Quite possibly, yes, depending on how well she is or isn't. All pregnancies are different. I've had two pregnancies and both of mine were different. So, I think that's a valid point. But I think the point of that case was what was done wasn't proportionate, and some other proportionate response should have been found. And the suggestion that the claimant in that case put forward, the man, was, why didn't you do it this way? The other question is, if they'd just given her the role because she is a priority and she was on maternity leave, would that have been okay? I've always wondered with this case, and I haven't read the judgment for a really long time, so I can't remember what the conclusion is, but I've always wondered for this case why that wasn't what was actually pleaded. Because I think in a scenario where you have people competing for a role, but you have someone who is in the protected period, and that protected period starts when they go on maternity leave and it ends when they come back from maternity leave. So if someone's on holiday after maternity leave, but it's all one joint period, that holiday doesn't count. They're not protected anymore. It's only the period of maternity leave that's protected. I think that if she was still on maternity leave when this was going on, the obvious thing to do would have been to still go through a process, because I think it's important for that fairness to not just, you know, trying to generally in employment law, avoiding just dumping someone in without thinking about it is a really good idea. But I think had they gone through that process, he potentially scored higher than her, but actually she had the capability to do the role, then yes, I think Regulation 10 would have meant that she was placed in that role. Do you agree, Peter?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Again, yeah. It's been a long time since I've looked at that judgment, but effectively she had the right to take priority on any available work.
But it may have been that some of this went on when she was outside the protected period. She might have just come back to work. That might have been the reason. I can't remember off the top of my head, but hopefully that answers your question anyway. We've run over. Sorry, but it's a huge topic. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something from it. I hope it was clear. And we are back next week with another Employment Law 101 session. I'd love to tell you what it's about, but I can't remember.
It's going to be something exciting. And if you're so what I would say is the recording of this session, both the audio is going to be on Spotify. The video recording will go onto our website. We'll publish it on LinkedIn. Also, we've got a good session from Tupi last week, which ties in with this. So please take a look if you haven't seen that one. But otherwise, we look forward to seeing you all again next Thursday.
Take care, guys. Thanks for joining.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
Bye.